So I'll do the last question first, for a change. The Ajahn is not knowing better than knowing sometimes. Not knowing leaves you wonder. Thanks, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I don't know. Is not knowing better than knowing sometimes. Not knowing leaves you wonder. Ah, I think I understand. Because when you know something, it means you don't even look further. You think you've captured the essence, which means you don't even look deeper into things. So it's true. I used to know all the names, not all the names, but a lot of the names of the stars and the constellations, because I was really interested in astronomy. But then it meant every time I looked at the stars, I could never see them. I could just see their names, like little labels written on the sky. And I realized I'd lost the beauty. So I trained myself to forget all of those names of all those stars, so I could appreciate the stars just like everybody else. Something very beautiful. But when you think you have the name of something, that's where you think you own it, have power over it, and have fully understood it, which means you haven't seen it at all. It's just like in life, in your relationships. If you think you know the person you live with, the relationship is dead. Because there's no more interest anymore in a relationship with another person. You're always seeing new things which you'd never expected to see before. And just like in meditation, you're seeing new things about yourself, things you'd never noticed before. If you come to this, look at me, you always see new jokes you've never heard before. And somebody sent me a new joke a couple of days ago about how easy it is to be a psychologist in Australia. All you need to say is, good day, mate. No worries, she'll be right. Off you go. Well, it's not a bad joke. But anyway, is not knowing better than knowing sometimes? If you know the answer to that, it's better not to know the answer. Higher Ajahn regarding power, fame, and its opposite, powerlessness in the eight winds of change. His periods of powerlessness, not knowing what is going on in life, and his associated vulnerability, what the Buddha said was a natural wind of change in life, and not to be avoided or defended against. Thanks. Okay, they've got the eight worldly winds. Not really, this is the eight lokadhammas, it's really cool. Like praise and blame. And like fame and notoriety. And what's the other one? Happiness and suffering. And the last one, I've got to think very quickly. Gain and loss. Yes, thank you very much. What would I do without you? Thank you so much. You see, I don't know things. So it is better not knowing sometimes than to know sometimes. Because that way other people can give the opportunity to make good karma. So, yeah, those are the winds. So power and fame and its opposite, powerlessness. And the eight winds of change. Yeah, sure. Sometimes you're really famous. But don't think if you're famous you've got power. The more famous you are, the less possibility there is for you to do what you want. I remember Angie told me that a long time ago. You better be careful, Ajahn Brahm. So many people in Singapore know you. If you do anything wrong or mischievous, I will know. So, oh my goodness. I better behave. Too many people can see what I'm doing. They recognize me. So,
I was more interested in the powerlessness.
The powerlessness. That's why when you're faint.
Powerlessness and vulnerability are very close together.
Yeah.
In a great deal of time, certainly with many people in the world, including in my experience professionally, we avoid the state of powerlessness like a plague. And if we experience powerlessness at the end of something, it's dreadfully wrong. And my question is really orientated towards asking you, is that just like the weather or like the seasons?
They do change, yeah, but no, it's actually, that's the natural state of things. Like, you know, I've been telling the monks the last few days, I've got an authority crisis. I've had it ever since I understood the Dhamma. I'm not in charge. I've got no power. I can't even control my mind. So I give up all authority. That's called my authority crisis. You go and stay at Bodhinyana Monastery, you know that just I don't control that place. Do I? Venerable Santuti. We just had a vote a few days ago. Should we wear jackets or not wear jackets? Or should we just do whatever we want? And I said, no, we should all do it together. And I got outvoted. So now the monks wear jackets whenever they want. I've got no power at all. I'm totally powerless. I've been trying so hard to make you enlightened. And I just can't do it. I'm powerlessness. I haven't even got the power to stop you asking a question back. Exactly. What are you doing? Put your money on wisdom. Yeah, wisdom is much better. You didn't have any power to begin with, so you're not in control. It's the old simile of the driverless bus. I didn't say that this morning about sort of non-self, so here it comes. Life is like a journey in a bus. And sometimes your bus journey of life goes through some very beautiful scenery. Wonderful alpine mountains and beautiful waterfalls and rolling meadows and little cows chewing the grass. It's so wonderful. And you want to say, stop. I want to take a photo. I want to enjoy this. It's wonderful scenery. So you tell the bus driver, the one in charge of your life, slow down. I'm enjoying this. I want to sort of stay here as long as possible. And your bus driver puts the foot on the accelerator and speeds out. And then other times, your bus journey of your life, you're going through the toxic waste dumps of life. The degraded industrial areas with graffiti on the wall, with syringes on the sidewalk. You know, the desolate places of life. And you tell the bus driver, ah, this is so dangerous and scary and ugly. Get out of here as soon as we can. And the bus driver puts the brakes on and you stop. That is life. Sometimes when things go wrong, why do they go wrong? Why can't I get out of here quicker? Why is my stupid bus driver put the brakes on when that's unpleasant, painful, and disappointing? Why does all the suffering last so long? And when it is happy, why does it last so short? Why can't I stop to enjoy the happy moments of my life? And the stupid bus driver, that's the reason. And that bus driver's name is Will. Will Choice, that's his name. Will is your bus driver, because that decides whether you're going to go fast, whether you're going to go slow. That's your bus driver. So, you decide the only way to have a happy life so you can go fast through the painful times of your life and slow down to enjoy the pleasures of life is to go and teach that bus driver, Will, how to drive the bus. But in order to teach the Will how to be wise, you've got to find the Will first of all. And that's the job of meditation, stillness and insight. And in this meditation, finally, you go deep inside and you find the bus driver's seat, the seat of your will, the place where all these choices are made. And that's where you get the shock of your many lifetimes. You find the bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one sitting behind the wheel. It's empty. No one there. That is the insight I was talking about this morning. The bus driver of your life, there's no one there. It's all causes and conditions. Process. No one driving it. You are out of control. There is no one powering your bus. So as a result of that, you just go back to where you sat. And you stop complaining. The reason you stop complaining is no one to complain to. Suffering, happiness, just part of life. No craving, no ill will, no complaining anymore. That's the ending of craving and ill will. When you know there's no bus driver there, it's no pointless. So you don't have any power anyway. about time you realize that. You're totally out of control. That's why, what was one of the stickers we had on the Buddhist Society issued? Relax, everything's out of control anyway. Isn't it a beautiful one? Have you been trying to control your journey on this retreat? Have you got anywhere? You've got nowhere. So just, no one's got anywhere. So just enjoy it. You're just par for the course. So stop trying. Let go. No control. And that's really the one marvelous things. You know that, and that is being vulnerable. Vulnerable to peace and wisdom. We don't like being peaceful because we're afraid. We don't like being wise, because who knows what that will mean for us. But we'd rather stay in our comfort zone, just like the person in prison. When they are told their release date is coming up, they don't want to leave. They're comfortable in prison. They'd rather stay there than go out into freedom. Just like you. Or like that wonderful story in my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, about the worm and his lovely pile of dung. There's a beautiful story, and it comes up now, and it's actually a video of it made done by the Indonesians. But once there were these two monks, and these two monks were the best of friends, and they hang out together all their life, and when they died, one of them was a very good monk and got reborn in the heaven realms. And the other one, because he was too lazy and slept too much. No, I didn't look at anybody. Got reborn. Sorry. Got reborn as a worm in a pile of shit. Now, because these two were the best of friends, the heavenly being was just started wondering, I wonder where my friend has been reborn. And so he looked around the whole heaven realm looking for his friend, couldn't find him anywhere. I thought, he must have been reborn as a human being. Because that's one of the better lives, even better than being in the heaven realms. So using his psychic powers of a heavenly being, he searched all the human realm and couldn't find him anywhere. Oh my goodness. Perhaps he was born as an animal. So he checked the animals, the elephants and the tigers, all these big animals, proud and good animals, couldn't find him there anyway. So then he checked out the creepy crawlers, the things which slither on the ground. And there, to his disgust and horror, he found his friend. The friend who was a monk in a previous life had been reborn as a worm in a pile of cow shit. And he thought, you can't just leave a friend in such a terrible rebirth. So he went down to the pile of cow shit and called out to his friend. And the little worm poked his head out of the pile of dung and said, what do you want? And the heavenly being said, we were the best of friends in a previous life. We were monks together. Now because of my good karma, I've been reborn in heaven. It's beautiful up there. It's a lovely place. And you, unfortunately, have been reborn in this pile of shit. But look, I can help you. Come up to heaven with me. I can take you up there. And the worm said, hang on a moment. Up in heaven, is there any shit? Of course there's no shit in heaven. That's disgusting stuff. And the worm said, no shit, I'm not going. Because I like my shit. And I eat it. It's delicious. And it's where I live. It's warm and it's fragrant. There's no shit up in heaven. Can I take some with me? No! So the worm said, I don't want to go. And the heavenly being thought, well, if I could only show the worm heaven, so he could experience it for himself, then I'm sure he'd like it, and he would understand with insight that the heaven is much better than living in a pile of shit. So the only way he could do that, he grabbed the worm and tried to pull him out of the shit. But the worm didn't want to go. And because he was all covered with slimy shit, when he wriggled, he soon escaped the heavenly being's hands and went right in the very deepest part of the pile of shit. But friendship is so great that the heavenly being, even though he's a refined, even a human being, you wouldn't put your hand in a pile of shit. This was a heavenly being, like a high being. So he held his nose and he put his hand in there and tried to find his friend. And eventually found his friend and pulled him out, and the worm kept on complaining and shouting and wriggling, and soon wriggled out again. And he sort of went back in, and then he pulled himself out again. He wriggled away again every time. He almost got him out of the pile of shit, but the worm didn't want to go, and wriggled away. And after many, many times, in the book I said 108 times, here I say 7 days. For 7 days. You've got the message. You've been meditating for 7 days since you started. For 7 days, the heavenly being tried to pull the worm out of the pile of shit. He almost got him out, but then he wriggled back in again. And so the heavenly being had to go back to Bodhinyana Mosque. I mean, and all the little worms had to go back to their homes and jobs and wives. Why is that? Because I like my shit. It's my home and it's fragrant. Why don't you let go of your shit? It's fascinating. It's called attachment. That's why it is brainwashing. It is tricking you. This is a trick. And I'm honest with this. I'm trying to trick you into samadhi. So at least you get into jhana. This is better than sex. Good idea. And then when you sort of get into samadhi a few times and see how still it is, then you realize what shit is and what heaven is. It will change you. I'm a very sneaky monk. Dear being of light. Yes, I am very light. I've lost a lot of weight since I've been here. Dear light being. Women's, men, girls or boys, we are all the being of light. I am, I am, I am. Fair enough. But I'm not a being of light, I'm a being of heaviness. I'm a monk of gravitas. It seems that the Fourth Noble Truth, Eightfold Path, increases inner happiness and contentment. Yes. And thus decreases craving. Undermines Second Noble Truth. Yes. Is this understanding correct? Yes. I have the Four Noble Truths. Leads to cessation of craving. Yes, that's good enough. 10 out of 10. Come up for your prize afterwards, I'll give you a haircut. What a wonderful treat to hear the Dhamma from such a wise and skillful teacher. You help us find the path inside the present and away from your pile of shit. I agree. Ajahn, can you let me know where can I find the suttas you mentioned earlier in the sutta book? That's where you find the suttas. The sleepy monk who became an arahat 2 weeks later. Now, that's in the Majjhima Nikaya. I remember just know which one it is? It's in there somewhere anyway. I know that usually my index is Ajahn Brahmali. So I said, where is it? And he knows it straight away, so I get very lazy. It's in there. Buddha talked to Ananda about the perception of sex. I think that is in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Mara as spiky-haired creature to test the Buddha. That's not Mara. It was called Asuchi Loma. And that's in the Sanyutta Nikaya. Suttas on Nimitta. And that is... I just got it the other day, I think it's 108, I think. That was the Upakalesa Sutta. So that's all recorded. So if you really want to see those later on, you can come and just get those from me. I got all those little books in the office, so you can come and have a look at them. Dear Ajahn, if we have no choice in what we do, how do we transcend karma? You've got no choice but to transcend karma. How are we be morally responsible? You've got no choice but to be responsible. What is the point of walking the path? You've got no choice. You have to walk the path. You can't stop. You try and stop. You just can't do it. That's why you keep walking the path. You think you can get around this teaching of non-self by thinking, well, if that's the case, there's no will here, I'm going home. You try it. You can't do it. There was this hypnotist, I think it was called, I remember his name, I think Zeno the Hypnotist. I think he does stuff in Burswood. And I know his name because one day we had a spare, I think, photocopier or fax machine, I forget what. And we had it in the newspaper for sale. I forget what it was. What is it called? That the Quokka or something. And somebody rang up. They wanted a photocopy or a printer or something. And it was this guy, Zeno, the hypnotist from Burswood. And I should have warned the person who sold it because he sold it very cheaply. The hypnotist probably hypnotized him. It was actually one of my favorite cartoons, I think, a Gary Larson cartoon or something. There was this hypnotist. He was accused of some crime. And so there he was in the dock. And the judge said, "You know, you've done a terrible crime," sort of, Zeno the hypnotist. "So I hereby sentence you to 12 weeks in Bali in this resort at the taxpayer's expense." And you get the joke, he's a hypnotist, he hypnotized the judge. So be careful when you have hypnotists around. But I remember just reading a report of this, you know, hypnotist show. It was amazing. You know, in the audience, all the people, he said, "No, you can't stand up anymore, you have to sit down." And they couldn't stand up. They had to sit down. It's amazing just how a hypnotist, you know, you think, "Oh, that doesn't happen to me, no, it's just some stupid guy." But no, they actually can make you actually sit down and you can't get up. It's amazing just what a hypnotist can do. So are you really in control? You are not in control.
A lot of people want to be.
Yeah.
You know, I throw up and the hypnotist gives me permission to get up. Seeing God say, "Please, there's someone." I love to do these things, but they can't do a human
Or is that just an excuse? You're made to love those things. That's why you do them. So this is very interesting. How much choice you have. And this, the classic case when you sing, say, singing the national anthem, this is one of those personal stories. You've heard these ones before, but this really shocked me. I was a student at Cambridge, and the three societies which I joined were the Astronomical Society, because, you know, I loved sort of looking at the stars, the Buddhist Society, for obvious reasons, and the other one was the Psychic Research Society, because I loved weird stuff, ghosts, psychic phenomena, witchcraft, anything weird. And one of the, every year, we'd have a hypnotist come and give us a demonstration. And the first, I used to go every year, it was always good fun. And now you imagine a group of guys, you know, 18, 19, 20, in a big hall with a hypnotist. You know, it's not serious. We want some fun and games. So the hypnotist, you know, any volunteers, and everybody volunteers. You know, I went up there, but I'm not a good hypnotic subject because you don't mind making a fool of yourself, you know, in front of your friends. It's just, you know, it's par for the course. You go out for a good time. So, but there's always, every year there was one guy. It's amazing just how this hypnotist can get them into a very deep trance the very first time and make them do really ridiculous things. Pull your pants down, stand on your head, all those sorts of really ridiculous things, which for young teenagers or, you know, that sort of age, we think is hilariously funny. So we had a great time. But the serious part, the one which I went, wow, that was really worthwhile going to, was when the hypnotist told his student in the trance, "In a few minutes, I'll take you out of the trance, and after you're out of the trance, I'm going to touch my right earlobe. When I do, you're going to stand up no matter what's happening and sing the British National Anthem in a loud voice." And I wanted to see if that would work. He took him out of the trance, he went to sit down. Everybody in the audience knew this was going to happen, but this guy didn't. Because, you know, he'd had the post-hypnotic suggestion to forget it. You know, he wouldn't be conscious of it. And the hypnotist was a really good entertainer, because every now and again, he'd move his finger to his ear, and then he'd move it away again. You know, this is really good entertaining. So then, eventually, he touched his right ear. And this student, he stood up in the lecture theatre, and in the loudest voice, sang "God Save the Queen." And we were peeing ourselves laughing. It was the most funniest thing, roaring. Now usually if you do something silly and people laugh, you stop. But this guy would not stop. He carried on to the very end. And it was the most ridiculous thing we saw. We thought it was a great joke until the hypnotist stopped us laughing and said to this guy, "Why did you do that?" And then this man, he wasn't at all embarrassed. He gave a legitimate reason. A cogent reason. And at that, you know, it's one of those times, you know, the hair on the back of your head goes up. It was very obvious to me and to most of the audience that that young man was of the very clear impression he'd freely chosen to sing the national anthem. A most ridiculous thing. But to him, it appeared it was his free will. And that I went home wondering, gee, how much of my free will is free, or how much of it is conditioned? That started me really wondering about this choice business. The point is, if you've been hypnotized, you cannot distinguish what impression has been put in your head by someone else and what has been chosen by yourself. There's no distinguishing there at all. You just don't know. You can't know. That is scary. But eventually you find out what the will is. So that is actually what's going on there. Ooh, that is truth. We don't like to think like that. We always like to think we're in control. Are you? Dear Ajahn, I have been reflecting on the truth of impermanence. This has been coming up very strongly. I feel I haven't developed enough wisdom or insight into non-self. As such, I am left with a deep sense of sorrow and insecurity. If my life is like sand falling through my fingers, I feel that I'm in an in-between space, not yet settled with wisdom to embrace the Four Noble Truths. How can I manage this? I am concerned this will hinder my practice and cause depression. No, it's always good fun. Now, developing on impermanence, you're just on a journey. The more you develop wisdom, the less suffering and depression and unhappiness you have. Now, why get depressed when there's no one to get depressed? What are you afraid of when there is no future, there is no past? It's just this present moment. So you're just here, enjoy yourself. So the deep sense of sorrow and insecurity. The sorrow is looking at the past, the insecurity is looking at the future, and always looking with a negative angle on things. So, yeah, the past is the past, but you can look upon it with sorrow, you can look upon it with happiness, the future as well. As I mentioned in our wonderful last 3 minutes of Life of Brian, even when you're on the cross being crucified, you can always look on the bright side of life. Brilliant. Why not? So you can actually do that, and people do that, and it's wonderful when they can do that. And it shows it's possible. It means it's just, you know, dying, or just, you know, not getting your own way, or being bereft of what you like. That's not the cause of suffering. Having a close loved one die, that's not the cause of suffering. Your reaction to these things, that's the cause of suffering. That's the cause of suffering, of sorrow and despair. It's not life. It's how you look at life. Your attitude. And that's a wonderful realization, because you can't change life. People are always dying. They're always doing stupid things. They're always just, you know, asking stupid questions and coming and spending too much time on the interview chair. And not laughing enough at my jokes. It's really awful being me. But instead of feeling so depressed about this, no, look on the bright side of life. So it's attitude, because I can't change the world. That's why in monastery, you can't change monks, that's just who they are. You can't change nuns, that's who they are. It's like trying to change the teddy bear. Come on, sit up straight. How many times have I told you to sit up straight? And don't be so smug. Did that do anything? Did that change? It's a total waste of time. So, like, trying to teach you is like trying to teach the teddy bear. Trying to change life Teddy bears are teddy bears, that's their nature. You are you, that's your nature. So don't take anything and bang yourself on the head. That's called sorrow and insecurity. Life is like sand falling through my fingers. It's not, you have many lives. This is only one of thousands of millions of trillions and zillions of life. So what are you worried for? Don't be in such a rush to become enlightened. You've got millions of lifetimes left. So plenty of time. Take it easy. Chill out. The less you're in a rush, the faster you achieve the goal. The faster you run, the more the carrot runs in front of you. When you stop, the carrot comes to you. The Ajahn is seeing the impermanence of ordinary sense perceptions part of the way to familiarize and accept change so as to allow letting go into meditation to happen without fear or control of perception. Yeah, look, all your sense perceptions, like I already mentioned about beer. Is it delicious or is it not delicious? The food at this retreat, is it delicious or not delicious? If it was really delicious, everybody would take everything of the same dish. That's why I have many dishes, because some of those dishes you like, some you don't like. It's all, and people take different things. I can't understand it. Why doesn't everybody like fish and chips? It's the most delicious food in the whole world. That's all we should have every day, and for breakfast as well. Why not? It's the most wonderful thing. But what I like is not what you like. And sometimes you change your likes. Sometimes you don't feel like it today. You feel like something else. So even your likes change. And what you sort of enjoy. So all your sense perceptions, you can't rely on them. I remember it was how many years? About 10 or 12 years before I got my first hot fish and chips here in Australia. You know, sometimes as a monk eating frog on rice, sometimes you would dream of fish and chips. And after about so many years, sometimes they'd give you fish and chips here. You'd have to put curry on top because it all goes in the same bowl. You know, it wasn't nice. So once I remember I had to do a funeral service in the early morning, and it wasn't enough time to get back to the monastery for lunch. Ajahn Chakra was the abbot, I was number two. He said, just get yourself something to eat on the way back. You mean I can get myself something to eat? Actually choose something? Yeah, great! So I found a fish and chip shop. And for the first time, I mean, just fish and chips, none of the sort of the curry or other stuff, the sanya on other stuff which you offer on top. Just fish and chips in a piece of paper, with vinegar and salt and hot. Because the stuff you get here, by the time it arrives and you do all this, chanting and stuff, and all the other monks in the end of the line, they take forever to choose what they want. So whatever you eat here is always cold. But this was hot. And this was it. What I've been dreaming for about 12 years. You don't realize what it's like being a monk or being like a nun. You know, the stuff which you really like, you just can't get. And when you do, someone messes it up and they do stupid things with it. But this was it. Hot fish and chips from the fish and chip shop. And I ate it. And I had a tummy ache afterwards. A stomach ache. It was such a letdown, such a downer. So why was it? All these perceptions which I had, when it became real, it never lived up to its promise. How many times in life has that been the case? Something you've dreamed of, something you've salivated over, and when you actually get it, big deal. Why did I waste so much time wanting this? That's even this retreat. Even if you have a bad retreat, you will change your perception that this was a pretty good retreat, no matter how good or bad your meditation. And the reason is because if you're really honest and say this was a hopeless retreat, I really sort of bombed out, this was a terrible time I had, You feel so embarrassed to tell your friends back home that you spent so much money and so much time wasting your time. That you always say when you go home, you always say something positive. I learned a lot on that retreat. You change your perceptions just to fit what you want to tell people. That's the trouble with sense perception. You can't trust them at all. They're all lies. This is the best retreat. All lies. You want to say that? Where did that come from? Conditioning. Please explain two citadels. And actually, that Sid did say that. It's really here. See, this actually said that this is the best retreat. I didn't make these things up. Please explain the two citadels of self, Dua and Nara. Is that framework necessary? Can't we abandon self-view without going through our rupas? Oh yeah, you can abandon self-view without going that deep. But those are the last places when you take away everything else. That's not me, that's not me, that's not me, that's not me. You always end up in those two places. That's the last place where you think you hang out. But I am the knower, or I am the doer. Those are the two things you identify with. So eventually when you get rid of everything else, being a girl, being a boy, being old, being young, being intelligent, being stupid, and all this other stuff which has been conditioned into you, you get rid of all of that and you sort of pare it down. You're not the body. You're not your sort of experiences in the past and attainments. It always comes to this thing which knows, or this thing which reacts or will. And that's what you home into. Now that's one of the reasons, you know, why the Buddha, I always thought, why did the Buddha teach these five khandhas? You know, that split up this world into these five sections of no body and material things, especially the physical body. The svedana, this sensation of pleasure and pain, perceptions, the sankharas, which is basically will, and consciousness. Why did the Buddha split up the body and mind into those five parts? And the answer is, it's not said in the suttas, so I think the answer is because these are the five things you take to be you. First of all, the body. I don't know how many people think that when the body dies, that they die as well. They identify with this body so much. And some people identify with this body so much when they start going old. That's not who they really are, this old man. So they start taking Botox, they start dyeing their hair. I don't dye my hair. And they start pretending they're not the age they truly are. So why do you do that? It's just attachment to the body. What's wrong with getting old and fat and just weak and falling apart? You're all over the hill. Someone told me a long time ago, I think it's about 23 or 24, that's when you have the most brain cells. After that time, you start losing brain cells in your brain. So you're basically the number of gigabytes or megabytes you have in your brain starts to decrease from that time. So after 23 or 24, you're all over the hill intellectually. A lot of you are very well over the hill. Almost at the bottom. Yeah, you like it? Yeah, it's true. It's quite nice at the bottom of the hill, isn't it, Barbara? Yeah, it's very nice down there. This body. That's the first one. You knock off that karma in me. This feelings. Happiness and suffering. Beauty and ugliness. You always try and control that. You find after a while you can't. You don't own it. And that's when you get that wonderful realization that all happiness is a space between two moments of suffering. The more suffering you have, the happier it is afterwards. You know, this is an old story, that one of the happiest people I ever saw were this group of Iranian refugees arriving at Perth Airport. I think they're the Baha'is, where the Baha'is were almost exterminated by the Iranian Revolution. You know, when the Islamists took over, they persecuted so many minorities, and that was one of them. And you know, the ones who survive, you know, being taken away in the middle of the night, tortured and killed, managed to basically run away with the shirts on their backs over, I think, to Pakistan, to the refugee camps, and were finally resettled. So these people had been refugees from persecution for 2 or 3 years. And when they came through the old Perth airport, now I saw them come through, I was waiting for a monk on the same flight, they punched the air and they literally leaped for joy. And when they leaped for joy, I found myself punching the air too. Hang on, I'm not Iranian, I'm not Baha'i, I'm a Buddhist, I'm waiting for a monk. It was infectious. And I thought afterwards, why were they so happy? And they were so happy because the amount of suffering and pain they'd just come through and escaped from. If they hadn't been so persecuted and had so much pain and suffering, they wouldn't be that happy. And that was one of the first times I realized that all happiness and joy, its intensity depends upon the suffering which has just been overcome. And I remember I never felt so healthy as when I overcame scrub typhus and came out of hospital. I've actually probably been much healthier since, but then because of the suffering of a fever for about 4 weeks, they had something to compare what I felt like, and I felt so healthy and I really appreciated it. That's why you can't have happiness without suffering. You can't have suffering without happiness. The two will always go together. You will never have a perfectly happy retreat. Sometimes you only get to second jhana, that sucks. I need third jhana. This is actually very true. All of your, this is a nice thing to know, you can't have eternal suffering. Just when the torturers just torture a little less intensely, that's happiness for you. And I mean that. There's another sort of story. It was written, this book, about the Argentinian junta in the 70s. And it was a book called, Prisoner Without a Name, Cell Without a Number. It was a journalist, one of the people who got taken away in the middle of the night into an underground military dungeon somewhere, he didn't know where, and tortured for a couple of years. Because he was a journalist and because he had friends in the United States, they asked questions, so he wasn't killed, he was eventually released. He wrote a book about his experiences. And one of the things which I remember reading, which really shook me, he told his wife, if ever he disappears in the middle of the night, please don't write to him. He gave her those instructions, but she never followed those instructions. And he was in his cell, you know, in the middle of, just after being tortured, and his electronic machines. And he'd been enduring this for, you know, for time, which he didn't really count the days. And the guards handed him this letter from his wife. And he said, that hurt so much. It made the torture 10 times more painful when he had something to compare it with, the memories of his life outside with his family. That is why torturers have the good guys and the bad guys. If you just get tortured, basically, please excuse me, you get used to it. Yeah, it hurts, but it's not that bad. But if you get a moment of happiness and freedom, that makes the torture just so sharp. This is the way of things. Happiness and suffering are a pair, inseparable. You can't have one without the other. If you understand that, you understand the second of the 5 khandhas. You always try just to get happiness, but you just can't do it. It's impossible. There's nothing wrong with you. It's not that you're stupid or make mistakes. It's actually impossible. Understanding that, you're understanding that happiness and suffering are out of control. You let it go. You don't seek it anymore. So you don't seek heaven. Heaven doesn't exist. And perception, we hang on to all these perceptions of our past. I was a really bad person. Or the future perception. 2012, it's going to be the end of the world. It's amazing because I'm trying to convince many people and they still believe it's going to happen. It's really ridiculous, isn't it? But all those perceptions, they're not ours. And of course, the last two of the khandhas, will and consciousness, the doer and the knower. That's why the Buddha had those khandhas separated out, because these are the main places we make identity from. Our body, our pleasures and pains, our perceptions, our will, and our knowing. It's a very, very powerful teaching. Anyway, I better keep going, otherwise we'll be up all night. Happy New Year to all Sri Lankans, 13th of April 2012. That's tomorrow. It's also Thais, and it's also Laos, and it's also Burmese. This is South Asian New Year, and Indians. And do you do that in Bangladesh? Yeah, Bangladesh too. That's Kubalo tomorrow. Very good. 13th of April, that's tomorrow. It's Happy New Year to everybody tomorrow. So tomorrow we can have a party? No, we'll have the party by getting all enlightened and having China. So that's tomorrow. Wishing Ajahn Brahm, the monks and nuns and all here, peace, happiness, contentment, bliss in China and beyond. I agree with that. Ajahn, do you know of monks who have disrobed after having attained jhanas? No. I know of many who have disrobed not having attained jhanas. And actually, that's one of the teachings of the Buddha. Now, what's that? The Sandhaka Sutra, I think it is, in the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha says, for monks, jhana is their happiness. That's their joy. And he said, a monk who doesn't get jhana, doesn't at least get that much, has no consolation. Basically, they've given up sex, they've given up movies, they've given up just eating the food they want and getting fish and chips hot whenever they like it. They've given up so much. So if they don't get the joy of jhanas, sometimes they wonder, what am I doing this for? They don't get that beautiful joy of renunciation. That's why one of the descriptions of jhana was nekama sankapa, the joy of renunciation, the happiness of renunciation. So that's actually why that if monks and nuns get deep meditation, may not be jhanas, but at least they get happy meditation, then they're going to stay as monks and nuns for a long time. But if you don't get them, then after a while you think, gee, sort of why am I doing all of this? And if I really want to serve Buddhism, I can, you know, join the Buddhist society and be the president or the secretary or something. You know, why do I have to sort of sacrifice so much? Because it's hard life being a monk or a nun. There's so many things you just can't do, which you take for granted. That's why you should try being a monk or a nun just for a few weeks, and then you'd appreciate just the great sacrifice of these noble monks in front of you and the noble nuns. That's very good. So, dear Ajahn, is emptiness the same as non-self? Yes, it is. So, emptiness means no self, nothing there, totally empty. And if you want to do the emptiness meditation, just think of your tummy in the evening. Empty, empty, empty. If any boy not respect his parents enough and make them down to others, but he feel that he is doing nothing wrong, is it bad karma? Or is it okay because he thinks it's right? Even if you think what you're doing is right, it still is bad karma. And if you go and sort of kill someone, even if you think they deserve to die, you still go to jail. So it's still bad karma. It has its consequences. So you have to be kind to your parents. They do have consequences, but it depends what you do. And there's always that wonderful simile in Buddhism. If you do some bad karma, you can always dilute it. The spoonful of salt simile. The Buddha said, if you put a spoonful of salt in a cup of water, you can't drink the water. It's too salty. But if you put the same amount of salt in one of the dams down here and stir it up, you won't be able to taste the salt. The amount of fresh water is so great, it'll be so dilute, you won't even notice the salt in it. So that's like good karma and bad karma. Bad karma, the spoon of salt. If you've only got a little bit of good karma, then it really hurts. But if you've done some bad karma, you can always dilute it by making lots and lots and lots of good karma. And how do you make lots and lots of good karma? The day after tomorrow, you can make sure your room is perfectly clean and everything is washed and put away. And your the place is nicely swept and you make nice big donation to Jhana Grove, and then all of your bad karma from the past will be diluted and you probably won't even feel it. Did that work? No. I'll have to try again tomorrow. But that's what you do. If you made some bad karma, dilute it, for goodness sake. Next question. How come supposedly attained people, monks, would say things that are not in tune with the Dhamma, e.g. about bad karma as a woman? Ooh. Because that was a very nice monk the other day. And he was saying, it's only, Duryupa said, he was only reportedly said. We don't know whether he actually really said that. That's just what somebody heard. And I know that because some people say, I said amazing things. I say, I never said that. Because what happens is the word goes around, and the word goes around and around, and always gets changed and says different things. And people just misunderstand, that's all. They sometimes you say something, but you know, they misunderstand what you say. Because I said the other day, do you remember I said, when people ask, can a woman become enlightened? I said, no, they cannot become enlightened. And I said that. But that was a joke. No, I was saying that to try and upset somebody, and just to say what it was like. But sometimes you can get it out of context. Now, you can become enlightened, okay? That is the real teaching. But sometimes I said this out of context, you know, just to get a reaction out of somebody. To tell them about what anger is. Now, sometimes you can say things out of context, and that's what gets reported, and people misunderstand what you said. Just like that story many years ago, there was a lot of newspaper coverage of monks in Thailand, very famous senior monks, being caught with mistresses, breaking their precepts big time. And there were so many of these in the newspapers that one evening in Nolamara Temple, one Friday evening when I was giving a talk, I decided to make my confession. I did, I confessed. I looked down at the ground, as you do when you have to confess something. And I said to everybody, there's about 200 or 300 people there, I said, it's about time I confessed. Some years ago, I said, I spent some of the happiest times of my life in the arms of another man's wife. I loved her. We kissed, we embraced, we had a wonderful time. When I said that, everybody went so quiet. Just like you did. Except for those of you who know the punchline. And some people went for the door. Oh no, not Ajahn Brahm as well. You know, loving arms of another man's wife, that's adultery. And then I told him, that woman was my mother. In the loving arms of another man's wife. That was my dad's wife. I was a son. And when I said that, everybody cracked up. And the point was, when you first say something like that, if you hadn't read that story, that opened the door of your heart before. I spent some of the most wonderful times of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. You think straight away, that's adultery. But then when you explain it, you realize, oh no, it wasn't adultery, it's quite acceptable. You know, that's your mother. You know, it is another man's wife. So when you find a full explanation, you say, oh gee, I was about to criticize Ajahn Brahm for doing adultery, walk out the door, because I totally misunderstood. And how often in life is one misunderstood? That's the purpose of telling that story. A monk could say something, or a nun, or you could say something. You're totally misunderstood. Even if you said it, say, that's not what I meant, I just messed up my words. So be careful not to criticize people just because of what they say. You ask them again, is that what you really mean? So anyway, how can supposedly attained monks say things that are not in line with the Dhamma, e.g. about bad karma as a woman? Can I safely assume that they are not attained? After all, if they really say that, then I would agree with you. Or people who have lessened their own defilements to do not necessarily know or understand certain parts of the Dhamma. How come? You know that one of the troubles, please excuse me, in Thailand, is actually a lot of the people in Thailand, they don't look up these things for themselves, but they follow their teachers. It's the blind leading the blind. Now, if their teacher had a wrong understanding, they would just say, oh, well, the teacher did this, therefore it must be right. Without questioning. It's just the old education system in Asia. Whatever your teacher said, you followed. And it was like, rote learning. And, you know, the Western system, you challenge everything. You really question. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Western education system, it's sort of made more inroads into knowledge, into wisdom, into research. All the great scientific discoveries were made in the West. Why? Because they were rebellious. They could actually just go on different tangents and totally reject all the commonly understood truths to see things anew. But wonderfully now, just in Asia, that rote learning is now being pushed aside and people are asked to be innovative. That hasn't really reached places in the Sangha. But the hierarchy still will. So you have to believe what your teacher says, even though it's not right. So that's why, please, argue with me. Don't believe just because I say. Okay? You must not believe just because what I say. And they say, we must not believe just because Ajahn says. So difficult to make people challenge. How come? Karma is such an essential part of Buddha's teaching. How can someone who has attained say things contrary to what the suttas say? Karma is very, very difficult to understand. They say only a Buddha can really understand karma properly. Even enlightened beings, they can make mistakes on karma because it's a very, very difficult subject. Even the Buddha said that. And I don't believe it. Dear Ajahn Brahm, the Buddha mentioned 40 objects of meditation, including kasina, but Ajahn Brahm Mali said that he didn't talk about kasina much. Why is that? There are not many kasina meditation masters either. I would not recommend you to go to casino. That's what some people say, casino meditation. It's a very, very close word. Okay, now what, should we do the casino jokes? Really? Okay. This meditator really got into jhanas and developed a psychic power of being able to contact the heavenly beings. And he heard the heavenly being just one evening. So I want to help you. Go to the casino. Go to the casino. And so am I imagining this? Because sometimes, you know, these limiters you get, and the sound limiters, sometimes you don't know whether it's real or not. But it was clear again. Go to the casino. Go to the casino. So he decided to follow the instructions. As soon as he got inside the casino, he heard this being again say to his ear, go to the roulette table. Go to the roulette table. So he went to the roulette table. And actually, the thing, go and buy some chips first of all. Then go to the roulette table. I got that a bit wrong. Buy some chips. They bought some chips. Go to the roulette table. He went to the roulette table. And then he heard the sound. Put $10 on number 16. Put $10 on number 16. So he put $10 on number 16. The croupier put the ball in, spanned the wheel, and came out on number 16. He got this whole heap of chips. And he heard again. Put all the money on number 22. Put all the money on number 22. And so he put all the chips on number 22. He put the little ball in the roulette wheel, spanning. And the ball went in number 22. He was making a fortune. Put all the money on number 5. Put all the money on number 5. He heard this being say. So he put all the money on number 5. And they put the ball in the slot. They turned the wheel. And the ball went into number 6. Not number 5. And he heard the deva say, shit. Now I tell that story just to make it sure that even if you do contact devas, devas make mistakes. So don't just believe what devas say. They get it wrong sometimes. They're not enlightened beings. How would one know that he or she is a sotapanna? Does he or she need to be confirmed by the teacher? Yes, you come and do the sotapanna exam. and I will give you the... No, this is the thing about enlightenment. You can't know that you're enlightened, but you can know you're not enlightened. There's a lot of difference there. You know you're not enlightened because you still get angry. You still have lust. You're still afraid. So you be honest about yourself. That's a sign that you're not enlightened. But if you haven't got those things, it doesn't mean you are enlightened. It means maybe those hindrances or those defilements are just suppressed for a while by things like jhanas. Okay, another story which you've heard before about the time when I became enlightened. People like to know, are you enlightened, Ajahn Brahm? So I tell them the time I became enlightened. This was my fourth rage retreat in Thailand. It is very simple monastery in the northeast of Thailand. Even though it's very simple, I had much time by myself, and it was a rage retreat, meditating and getting deeper and deeper. And one night, late one night, walking on the walking meditation, you know that time, sometimes your mind gets so powerful, so strong, there's no hindrances ever taught, it's just so powerful and so still. And all these insights started coming. Because when insights come, you don't look for them. They just come. It's just obvious. I hadn't seen that before. And then late at night, maybe about 10 o'clock, I think a bit later if I remember correctly, the big one came. Bang! Wow! And that was it. Enlightened. That felt so good. And when these things happen, it's late at night, but you can't go to sleep. You lay down, but you're perfectly mindful. No sloth at all, but no thoughts. Your mind absolutely still, like your best meditation times 100. Perfectly poised, rested. And they got up at 2 o'clock, went to the hall to meditate, because 3 o'clock we'd get up every morning. And I was there an hour beforehand, perfectly still and straight. Usually in those days, it was very humid, you know, rains retreat time. You didn't really have much sleep and energy, always nodding. That morning, no nodding at all, perfectly still. No effort at all to watch the breath or whatever you wanted to do, perfect. And did the chanting with not too much energy, not too little energy, just beautiful chanting that enlightened beings would do. Oh, it was just so sonorous. And then I went on arms round after the chant, and all the people who gave food into my bowl, I just gave them the just powerful metta of an enlightened being. You're so lucky to be the first people to offer the food to a newly coined arahat. And I was just so magnanimous to the whole world. And then when I got back to the monastery, I was amazed, because usually it was the same food every day for weeks. The sticky rice, but that's all you got on arms round, plus rotten fish curry. No pladek, no thais. The rotten fish was fish they'd caught last season, and they put it in jars without any preservatives and just with a bit of plastic on top to keep for their protein source for the rest of the year. So it was actually... basically, like people used to do in England when they got caught rabbits or grouse, they'd hung them up until they went off. They called it game. And this was rotten fish. And it was stinky and smelled awful, and it tasted worse than it smelled. And we had that every day. Except today. Because that day, there was another pot which somebody had offered. And inside I looked, it was pork curry. Now, that actually tasted nice. Now, I was a vegetarian before I became a monk, but over there you just couldn't be a vegetarian. It wasn't vegetarian food. So it was pork curry, and that was really tasty. And I thought, wow, there are the devas are celebrating my enlightenment by giving me some delicious food today. And I thought, how sweet of them. And then after the chanting, we started, in those days, we'd actually pass the food down the line. And I was number two. There was an abbot there, still a monk. I saw him some years ago. And he took three whopping, really big ladles of this pork curry into his bowl. When no one could eat that much. Really greedy. And he was a local boy. That was actually his village. The village which supplied him food. That's actually where he grew up. And so I said, well, no, you should like the rotten fish curry. But he didn't mind. There's plenty left for me. And then he got hold of the rotten fish curry. Now remember, this is after he took his own out, pork curry, and he poured the rotten fish curry into the pork curry bowl and stirred the whole lot up, saying, it's all the same anyway, it's all the same anyway. And I thought, what a bloody hypocrite. If it's all the same, why didn't you put it all together and stir it up before you took yours? But you took yours first, and you spoiled mine. Now I can't eat the nice pork curry. I have to eat it with this stupid rotten fish curry. This is the first time in weeks we've got something nice to eat. And I am a Westerner. I can't take this rotten fish curry. Then I realise, hey, hang on, I'm supposed to be enlightened. And that really was a downer. If you talk about depression, that was really depression. When you thought you were enlightened and realized suddenly you weren't. So I just slopped whatever goes in my bowl, I don't care. I was so depressed and I just ate it. And I was really depressed all day. But that was actually a great experience for me, because everything was right there in place, just like enlightenment should be. And it fooled me. I was very lucky that that monk did that, otherwise I could have lost it for days. So it's very good. If you think you're enlightened, I'm going to find out what food you really don't like. And mix it in with what you take to see what happens. Anyway. I'll tell you in private afterwards if you want to know. I won't sort of. He's not a famous monk, but he's one of Ajahn Chah's disciples. Dearest emptiness Ajahn, now that I realize that bliss is actually better than sex, great! Can you please follow me home and explain to my young and beautiful wife? That sex is unpleasant and her husband is not interested in her anymore. Okay. I wouldn't mind doing it to your wife, but if it was to your husband, I think he might want to beat me up. Now, I'll send one of my disciples. Would you like to go? Yes, I'm a bit busy. Lastly, thanks for your loving kindness. We love you. And most importantly, we learn how to love ourselves by making peace in every moment. Be kind and be gentle to ourselves during meditation. Hee hee hee. It's a rewarding retreat for me. Thanks again from the lovely teddy bear. Is it for you wrote that? I don't think so. But anyway, another sort of lovely piece of praise. Now, it's good practice to keep praising people and praise each other. So before you leave, in a couple of days' time, please write little notes to the people you've shared your cottage with. And say thank you so much for making all that noise. That really taught me how to do it. No, don't do that. If you're going to play someone, do it properly. Okay, that's the end of the question and answer tonight. So I hope you enjoyed it. And tomorrow it will even be more enjoyable because I will be in Nolimara doing the Friday night talk. So someone else has to do the questions and answers. So tomorrow, four of you have to sit up here. And please make the questions. And when you ask the questions, please put on there who you want to answer the questions, whether the monks or the nuns. So it's a wonderful opportunity to ask the questions, of Venerable Sasanadaja, Santuti, Pasada, or Gotami. It's great, you know, instead of asking it of me all the time, these monks and nuns you've been meditating with all week can actually ask them questions. What's it like to be a monk? What's the thing which you find most disturbing and the thing which you like the most? Or any questions like that. So you can actually ask those questions tomorrow. So put them in the box. They won't be for me, they'll be for these four. It's really good fun. And I want to have a copy of that to listen to our... Okay, so... Sadhu! 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 Very good. Okay, you're not allowed to be sick tomorrow night. Very good.